This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Syria's civil war is quite possibly the worst humanitarian crisis of our time. Half the country's pre-war population, more than 11 million people, have either been killed or forced to flee their homes. The Syrian Emergency Task Force, or SETF for short, is a non-profit organization based in the United States that was established to convey the democratic aspirations of Syrians to the American public. I'm joined today by Salim Gandour, SETF's advisor, and hopefully over the phone by Moaz Mustafa. We're still waiting to hear on him. Hopefully we do. And he's SETF's executive director. And Salim will be telling me about their plans to expand their work to Southeast Asian countries, as well as to raise awareness of the continued oppression of the Syrian people. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lynn.
The violence in Syria began in March 2011, and the country has been crippled by a brutal civil war ever since. Who are the key players in this war?
The main player in the civil war, Lynn, is, of course, Bashar al-Assad. Bashar al-Assad is the son of father Hafez al-Assad, who died in 2003. So there was a passing of power when the father died and the son took over. So the Assad dynasty has been in charge of running Syrian politics for almost four decades now. And of course, Syria has been known and classified on and on again as a brutal police state. So, of course, Bashar al-Assad is the main actor in charge of the Syrian army and the Syrian security forces. Then, of course, you have the rebel fighters. Now, the rebel fighters is a very short summary of a vast constellation of different groups ranging from the extreme like the al-Nusra Front to the FSA, which is the moderate Free Syrian Army. And of course, finally, you have the very famous, unfortunately, or infamous ISIS. Now, ISIS, those are people who have really no covenants, who respect no rule, and their allegiances will swing to any place, whatever opportunity they have to wreak chaos and other tragedies. Now, this is within the domestic realm. What you have in Syria, however, is external players who are also actively participating in the conflict. On the Bashar al-Assad side, if I may denominate it this way, you of course have two very powerful forces, which are the Iranian government and Hezbollah. This trio has been actively coordinating, in a sense, and actively responsible for a lot of the massacres and crimes against humanity that have been going on in Syria. And then you have, of course, the Free Syrian Army, which unfortunately has been abandoned by the international community. 2 to 3 years after the start of the revolution, the Free Syrian Army had scored massive advances in the country and actually had the upper hand over the Assad regime. And finally, of course, you have ISIS, which is running around really uncontrolled. Finally, I can say finally, the international community is paying more attention to the Syrian conflict. But selfishly, if I can say, only because the refugee crisis has blown in Europe's face, do they now pay attention to this tragedy that has been happening. And Lynn, you very rightly put it. The number now stands at 12 million refugees, internal and external refugees. This is a conflict of biblical scale, if I can put it that way. So those are the main actors in the Syrian conflict right now.
And would it be safe to say that if you look domestically, because as you say, I think people have become more involved in this crisis because of the sheer numbers of refugees kind of dispersing across the world because of the acts of terror that you see ISIS committing. But for Syrian people specifically right now, looking at your options, is it a matter of being stuck between a rock and a hard place? Because, you know, we have on one hand, you know, this dynastic power that hasn't really been the healthiest. And then you have, on the other, people who are, as you say, running around uncontrolled.
This is the unfortunate truth. And that's why you have a refugee crisis. Look, refugees, especially now in the case of Syria, these people are not leaving Syria because of job opportunities and better economic landscape outside in Europe or anywhere else. These are people who are leaving desperately, their homes and cars and families burning because there's just no other choice left for them. And this is what we keep advocating to a lot of the European countries, Southeast Asian countries, and the United States, is that Syrian refugees want to go back home. But as long as you have an active state of conflict where the moderate forces are stuck in the middle, not supported, not assisted, then of course the refugee crisis is only going to increase. And you still have another 6 to 8 million internally displaced Syrians. These people are ultimately going to leave Syria if there is no moderate middle ground solution. And that's what we're doing here at the SETF, is empowering those people, making sure that their voices are heard across the world and that they get the support they need to build a free, democratic, healthy Syria in the future.
As you say, the situation as it stands, is an impossible one, if I may. How would you describe the current situation of the Syrian crisis? How has it changed or developed since it first kind of really blew up in 2011?
You know, Lynn, the Syrian conflict actually didn't blow up initially. What happened in Syria in 2011 was a peaceful rising of people. People asking for dignity, people asking for their basic human rights, people asking for opportunity. Syria has been plundered and impoverished by an extremely corrupt regime. And it's only normal to have people and youth who are disaffected and who are impacted by the severe economic downturn and the corruption to rise up and ask for just basic rights, crumbs. And they were faced, bare chests were faced with guns and tanks. And then, of course, the conflict snowballed into something impossible. Violence has gone in swift crescendos ever since, has not abated. But now you have a little much more complicated situation where you have ISIS, and of course you have Russia, who is actively bombing Syria right now. I have to call Russia's intervention in Syria what it really is. It's criminal. It's undermining the moderate forces in Syria. We have evidence that the Syrian army has actually been actively bombing moderate rebel positions, has not touched ISIS, and is actively supporting the Bashar al-Assad regime. And finally, one thing I find very distressing, Vladimir Putin just a few weeks ago was asked in the New York Times what he thought about Syria and why he was in Syria. He actually said Syria is the perfect playground to test Russian weapons as well. Not my words, his words. This is how sick Syria has become right now. It's incredible, difficult to grasp, heartbreaking.
We've talked a little bit about the key players. Now, I want to talk about ISIS. Could you elaborate on the rise of ISIS from the Syrian conflict? It seems to have just grown through this particular vacuum in some ways and suddenly just, I don't know what the word is for what they've become.
A cancer. That's what they've become. The origins of ISIS trace back to Iraq, specifically the Anbar province. One big policy mistake that the United States has done after the Gulf War II, or the invasion of Iraq started, was what they call the de-ba'athification process. So Saddam Hussein, who was a Sunni, which are a religious minority in Iraq, was removed from power as well as the whole security apparatus. Of course, those people, so the security forces, the armed forces, the commandos, police force, once they were removed from power, of course, disaffected and lost a lot of the huge privileges they had running Iraq. And we all know how Iraq was run, unfortunately. As they were pushed away from power and as the Maliki government in Baghdad was empowered and supported by Iran, this is where, of course, the Shia-Sunni conflict started in Iraq. On the one side, you had Iran, and on the other side, you had the Sunni population that was increasingly marginalized by the Maliki government. And I think this can be, and this is actually the root of ISIS. And as chaos grew in Iraq, and as most of those forces, disaffected forces, were pushed out to Anbar province, and of course, then they found a nice, beautiful, chaotic situation in Syria for them to grow further. The root of ISIS traces back to Iraq and has grown and has intensified through the vacuum left in Syria. But one more thing, Lynn, is ISIS is also extremely popular or extremely powerful, not popular, excuse my language, because this is the first time in the Middle East where you have a conflict of such severity with no intervention from the international community.
Yes, I was going to raise that. Why do you think that's happened?
Timing, Lynn. It's very unfortunate. The Syrian revolution started at a time when Europe was still is trying to emerge from a very severe financial, economic, and sovereign crisis. Same thing in the U.S. That's number one. So economic reasons. Number two, political reasons. I think the European and American public had grown tired of wars, especially after the Bush administration. And President Obama had run on a very aggressive campaign of making sure that he would be able to undo the wars that his predecessor had started. Of course, the way the White House executed this policy was extremely chaotic. You cannot just pull out hundreds of thousands of soldiers from the Middle East and expect things to fall into place. So it's again, all those factors put together, economic crisis, unwillingness to fight any more wars, that actually allowed the Syrian crisis to grow to such grave proportions.
I'm speaking today with Salim Gando, advisor to the Syrian Emergency Task Force, or SETF. Coming up, we find out specifically when the SETF was formed and why, as well as their work here in Southeast Asia. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Joining me in the studio is Salim Gando, advisor to the Syrian Emergency Task Force, or SETF. Today we're discussing the Syrian conflict and the work that SETF is doing, particularly here in Southeast Asia. And before we get to that, so Salim, earlier you talked about why. I mean, there are multiple good reasons for why SETF should exist. But what was the real impetus for it to really kind of come into being? How and why and when did it really kind of happen?
Lynn, there was an urgent need for the moderate Syrian opposition to have a voice, number one. Number two, there was also a need for the Arab American community in the United States to organize itself and speak with a voice, to be able to steer the American public opinion towards having the U.S. play a more active role in pacifying Syria. And finally, it's just the gravity of the conflict. I know I'm using this word a lot, Lynn, but I'm running out of vocabulary to describe how difficult and sad the Syrian conflict has become. So really, the Syrian Emergency Task Force, again, is of course a not-for-profit. But what we try to do is drive policy work in Washington, D.C., and of course Southeast Asia right now, in making sure that, one, the exactions and the crimes committed by the Assad regime, by the Iranians and Hezbollah and the Russians are brought to justice. And of course, number two is giving a voice to the moderate Syrian opposition. And finally, organizing grassroots efforts to channel humanitarian aid to the people on the ground in Syria or in the refugee camps surrounding Syria.
And what shape is your work here in Southeast Asia taking?
Well, we're shaping the work as we speak
as
in Southeast Asia.
As you go, right.
The reason why Southeast Asia is a logical fit for our continued policy efforts with regards to the Syrian conflict, Southeast Asia is the second biggest cluster of Islam in the world. You have the Middle East, you have South Asia, and you have Southeast Asia. And we, of course, thought that there has to be bigger involvement of Southeast Asia, especially Malaysia and Indonesia in the Syrian conflict, because Islam in this part of the world enjoys a very peaceful environment and ecosystem, generally speaking. And we thought that we could leverage on this and work together with Malaysia and Indonesia to be able to bring about more urgency to the Syrian conflict. And we would frankly like to see those two countries play a more active role. We know that Indonesia and Malaysia and ASEAN in general is hungry for more power projection, is hungry for success and ambition. We think that Syria is the perfect case study for ASEAN, especially Malaysia and Indonesia, to showcase their moderation, to showcase their position against terrorism. But also Malaysia and Indonesia have no choice but to be involved in the Syrian conflict, indirectly, of course, because the Syrian conflict has already affected this part of the world. We've seen through the tragic Jakarta attacks a few days ago, and it will continue to. Prime Minister Najib has also taken a stance that he will absorb in 3,000 Syrian refugees. So there's no choice but to face this conflict and address the conflict. And we believe that Malaysia and Indonesia will be able to play a very positive role in ending this conflict or providing some solutions.
What are your thoughts on that pledge to take in 3,000 Syrian refugees? Is that enough? Is that too much? You know, how will? What is the process of? Because I think everyone worldwide is struggling with this. You know, how do you absorb this many people while trying to be, I think, thoughtful of their needs as well as cognizant of what your country can bear?
In the case of Malaysia, look, taking in 3,000 refugees is good. It's great. And the more we can take in, the better it is, I think. My only question mark with regards to the refugee absorption program in Malaysia is what is the long-term goal for those refugees? The big issue with Malaysia is the country is not a signatory of the United Nations Convention on Refugees. So technically, they wouldn't have access to work or school or health facilities. So we would like to see a more comprehensive policy on how the refugees would be taking in, what they would be doing, and how they will have access to education and work. And this is something we want to work with the Malaysian government. We understand that some of them will be absorbed in Malaysia as dependents from relatives who work here. So they will have that dependent visa. Other ones will be absorbed on student visas. And so on and so forth. But we really believe this is still very limited. And one thing we look at is the way Malaysia dealt with the Bosnian crisis in 1993 and 1992 when Bosnians were absorbed by the thousands into Malaysia, mostly young students given student visas. So there was a limited time scope to that solution. So we'd like to hear probably from the Malaysian government on what the end game is for those 3,000 refugees. Are you planning on taking them here for a few years? Is there a possibility of morphing their visas into a PR and eventually citizenship for their children? So we just want to understand that. I think otherwise it's a very good idea, I think, and very commendable to take in and absorb 3,000 refugees.
And from your standpoint, what would that comprehensive policy look like? You know, what would be the ideal situation for these 3,000 refugees coming here?
The ideal solution is for everyone to realize that those refugees, whether they're coming to Malaysia or they're going to the United States or Europe, eventually aspire to go back to Syria.
When they can.
When they can. And as soon as possible. So what I would like to see added to this policy is an active political involvement, especially Malaysia sits on the UN Security Council right now, a more active role by the Malaysian government to call out the exactions and the excessive of the Assad regime and play a more active role in the international community, really. I mean, we can morph and change and expand the policy on refugees as much as we want here. But as long as you do not deal with the source of that refugee crisis, the numbers are going to keep swelling. I understand, Lynn, right now from Syrians on the ground that there's about 30 to 50,000 Syrian refugees already in Malaysia. What are we going to do with them? Most of them probably are illegally employed. Most of them, are on student visas in Malaysia. So that number is going to swell. So 50 plus 3 is 53,000. And as the Syrian conflict goes on, as the community in Malaysia grows, you're going to have a mouth-to-ear word saying that, guys, come to Malaysia. It's peaceful here. The numbers are going to grow. So I don't see any end in sight as long as the Syrian conflict is not directly dealt with.
And it's interesting that we're talking about these numbers and they're, you know, just really unusually large numbers, because the UN predicts that there could be 4.7 million registered, and I guess that's a key word as well, Syrian refugees by the end of 2016. And that's the worst exodus since the Rwandan genocide 20 years ago. Many host communities are overwhelmed. New cultural tensions are being created, as we can see on the news with that. I think that constant sense of tension, of worry. I think people always fear the other, as when faced with them or when faced with threat. How can the world hope to cope with this absorption of millions? I mean, here in Malaysia, we're talking about 50,000, but really worldwide, as you say, 12 million.
Yeah. There's, again, an issue of timing. You have a Syrian crisis that is unraveling as right-wing populist political parties are becoming more and more popular in Europe and unfortunately to a certain extent in the US. Donald Trump is the perfect embodiment of a re-empowered racist minority.
The rhetoric is quite frightening.
There's really no other word than to call it bigotry. And this it's again rising, again on the back of an economic crisis that still has strong ramification. So timing is bad. The world has previously seen terrible conflicts, and refugees and migrants have always been successfully absorbed. I don't think 12 million is that big of a number on a global scale. But what we have to see is we need an international solution to this crisis. We have to see the United Nations lobby certain countries more effectively. I personally find it unfair that Turkey has to house 2.5 million Syrian refugees when Europe goes hysterical if they have to absorb 10 or 20,000. That is unfair. It is also unfair that Germany, which has taken in 1 million Syrian refugees so far, and France suddenly gets nauseous when they have to take in 3,000 or 5,000. So there has to be an agreement internationally that this is an international global moral obligation for all countries to play their part.
And how would SETF be a part of this?
Well, and this is what we're doing today with you, Lynn. What we want to do is, number one, clarify what the dynamics on the ground are in Syria. Unfortunately, there is still a lot of misunderstanding about what caused the Syrian conflicts, what are the dynamics in the Syrian conflict. So before we take in refugees and before any country makes any statement, we have to understand what the Syrian conflict is, what is happening on the ground, who is ISIS, how has ISIS grown away, or how has ISIS grown, and what do the refugees need, right? And unfortunately, now we have ISIS that is really making it very difficult for countries to pledge for additional refugees. As we've seen in Paris, as we've seen in Jakarta, the issues of those tragic terrorist attacks were actually homegrown terrorist issues, right? There were Indonesian nationals in Indonesia, and there were French or Belgian citizens in Paris. So it has nothing to do with refugees. So this is a message we have to keep sending to people. Refugees are disaffected people who just want to live under a roof and live safely.
That thing about I guess, the danger coming from within, about people being homegrown and threats to their country now. Why do you think ISIS has been so successful in that style of recruitment, in being able to capture people from, you know, different parts of the world and getting them to perform these or persuading. I don't know what the word is. I really struggle with the language of terrorism, I think. But, you know, I guess empowering them to act in these ways in their homeland.
There are a few reasons. First of all, Lynn, if you look at the modus operandi of ISIS, they're one of the first terrorist organizations to actually claim and have territory in their hands. They have resources available, selling oil and gas on the black market. They have what they call their khilafah, their caliphate, which they're building. So unlike other terrorist organizations, ISIS is very centralized and has a strong sense of loyalty. If you look at the way Al-Qaeda previously was structured, it was a very loose network of cells that were scattered all around the world, whereas now we actually have people from this part of the world, Indonesia, Malaysia, traveling to Syria, taking active part in the Syrian conflict, and coming back home to cause trouble and destabilize countries. So this is really the big difference of how ISIS operates almost as a nation state, if I may. It sounds very perverse, but that's how ISIS operates.
And what would it take to cause a shrinking of that territory and hurt the recruitment and propaganda efforts? Because I think social media is not helping in this sense, because it's unprecedented the way that terrorist organizations like ISIS can now really reach anybody at any time and do it in very quote-unquote attractive ways to the young people that they're trying to speak to.
First of all, the violence in Syria has reached, unspeakable permutations. So it's very easy for ISIS to generate the literature and generate the images of violence to cause grievances amongst many weak people. That's number one. Number two, Lynn, ISIS is also certainly successful because of the lack of international involvement in the Syrian conflict. If you look at now the international coalition that is bombing ISIS, 20-odd countries currently bombing ISIS positions, this is only one part of the way to weaken ISIS. The other part is, again, empowering moderate elements in the Syrian opposition, especially the Free Syrian Army. And finally, the big issue, which is the Assad regime. Assad regime is responsible for over 95% of the 350,000 dead in the Syrian conflict. Syria, the Syrian government, is still now actively barrel bombing civilian populations. I mean, just think about that concept, Lynn. They've run out of ammo. They've run out of missiles, the Syrian army. Now, basically, what they do is they take empty barrels of oil, they stuff them with nails, with TNT, and they just dump them over civilian neighborhoods. And the toll those barrel bombs have taken is tremendous. So what we are especially calling for here at the SCTF, Lynn, is a no-fly zone. At least try and neutralize the Syrian air force. So there's a three-pronged approach to neutralizing ISIS. One is, of course, attacking ISIS. We have to be unrelenting. But of course, and again, the Assad regime, and of course, supporting and helping the moderate Syrian forces.
Do you think the fighting is likely to end anytime soon, or is there a stalemate?
No, I think that the fighting can end. And again, that comes back to political willingness. Now, the good thing we have in the United States today is an end to the Obama administration. Don't get me wrong. I think he had and he did a great job domestically, but his foreign policy is riddled with faults and mistakes. So we have on both sides of the Democratic and the Republican side, we have candidates who are going to take a much more hawkish position towards Syria. Hillary Clinton has promised to be much more decisive with regards to Assad. Marco Rubio has also taken similar positions. So I think and hopefully once we have a new White House in Washington, D.C., a new administration, we're going to see a much stronger stance towards Syria. And hopefully through our work, Muaz and I here in Southeast Asia, we also want moderate Muslim voices in this part of the world to rise and say enough to violence and enough to crime and genocide.
Many countries are facing crises of their own, and I think that, especially when you start hunkering down and looking within your own borders, that can sometimes cause you to think, well, I have so many problems of my own. Why get involved with somebody else's civil war? Why? You know, why should they?
And I understand, and the argument makes sense. It's one, there's the moral obligation. That's very simple. Number two, Lynn, when you allow a conflict like the Syrian conflict to unravel continuously, you have the contagion effect. Just a few days ago, the Malaysian forces, security forces, apprehended a suicide bomber hours apparently before he detonated himself. If we don't deal with the Syrian crisis today, we're going to see additional contagion. We're going to see additional pressure on the country to mobilize resources towards security. And of course, then ultimately creating a climate of fear. So there's that link now. Malaysia and Indonesia have to deal with the Syrian crisis by hook or by crook. If Malaysians want to live safe, if Malaysians want to continue to live in prosperity, we have to deal with that Syrian crisis. And unfortunately, there is no shortage around the world of crazy people who will subscribe to ISIS's propaganda.
You've spoken about how important it is to have moderate Muslim voices. And I think for many people, hearing that the White House wants to get involved or the UN wants to get involved, these are kind of big symbolic organizations that we can understand as, you know, being able to play a role in something as large as the crisis in Syria. But for those of us here in Malaysia who might be thinking, well, you know, we're just kind of a small country in Southeast Asia, just trying to grow. What role does a moderate Muslim voice here in Malaysia, how loudly can it be heard? What should it be saying?
Malaysia enjoys a very positive reputation in the Middle East. And people in the Middle East have always aspired to see a role model. And to a certain extent, and until recently, that role model was Turkey. But now Turkey is, of course, being dragged into the conflict. As you can see, unfortunately, Istanbul and both Ankara were hit by terrorists. So I think Arabs and Middle Easterners, Muslims in this region, would like to see a country free of all that cultural baggage and historical cultural baggage to lead the way. Malaysia is now an upper middle income country. Malaysia is hungry for success. And I think the next phase of a maturing democracy in a maturing country like Malaysia is foreign policy, is power projection. Of course, it's going to need significant investment and resources to be able to formulate global policies. But we certainly hope that Malaysia is up to the task and has to play that role. Indonesia as well, I think, has done extremely well in that space. And of course, the Philippines are also trying to play a more active role on the foreign policy front. So I think that there's that aura of prestige. And let's be frank, Lynn, Malaysia used to play a very active role globally, especially during the Mahathir days and the Bosnian conflict, so on and so forth. Sometimes played a positive role, sometimes played a very negative role, such as name-calling, anti-Semitism, unfortunately, by Mahathir Muhammad. But Malaysia and the popularity of Malaysia today is still due to that positive role Malaysia played internationally 20 years ago. So there are those positive benefits that Malaysia can extract from playing a more active role in foreign policy.
For more information on the work that SETF is doing, you can visit syriantaskforce.wordpress.com. Thank you very much for coming in today, Salim.
Thank you, Lynn.
I've been speaking with Salim Gundur, advisor to the Syrian Emergency Task Force, or SETF. We have been discussing the Syrian conflict and the work that SETF is doing here, as well as the role that Malaysia could play in all of this. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.